I declare bankruptcy!
I congratulate you on your imagination, but this is a court of space law, not a theater.
Fax mentis incendium gloria culpum, etc., etc. Memo bis punitor delicatum. It's all there, black and white, clear as crystal.
How is this a fair trial? Our lawyer is a Morty.
It's not fair. You have no rights, and he's not a lawyer. We just keep him here because he's fun. Look at him go.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 146. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your other host, Andrew Torres. How you doing, Andrew?
Hey, Thomas. I'm great. How are you?
I'm excited for today's episode. We got some there's some craziness happening on our company whiteboard here, on our on our spreadsheet, our Google Doc. There's just there must be an error. What's going on?
Yeah, it one of our long running jokes is that the Trump administration and the world, I think it's fair to say the world as a whole, waits until Thursday afternoon really to release crucial documents, to take critical legal steps. They want to avoid being covered on Opening Arguments.
They're
hoping
it falls through
the cracks.
Exactly.
And we have a whole bunch of stories that have hit the news since our last recording a week ago today, and I thought it would be fun to tackle all of the legal aspects of those news. So, you know, what's going on with the budget deal that probably will be signed by the time this airs? It looks like we're heading in that direction. The Supreme Court gerrymandering in Pennsylvania. How could we fail to cover the Devin Nunes memo? Janet Yellen leaving the Fed. All of this great stuff. So
yeah. So instead of our normal three segment deal, we're going with it. We'll see how much Andrew can pack in, but we're talking 5, 6, who knows? Lots of stories. Andrew's going to try to give you all the crucial info in a short amount of time. So it's a challenge. We'll go. It's a speed round, lightning round, except more in depth. It's not going to be like this is not a, you know, quick slapdash of a thing, but it's an in-depth lightning round.
If you've ever been to any of our patron Q&As, I will answer this exactly the way I answer our lightning round questions, which is, you know, 10 to 15 minutes per question. That qualifies as lightning fast in the legal world. No, I'm excited.
I forgot. We established Andrew has no lightning mode. He has no lightning round mode. Okay, so let's get to it. Let's we got a lot to pack in. Let's get over. Brian, good luck with whatever introductions we're doing. I don't know. So let's just play something.
Thank you, Dr. Hibbert. I rest my case. Case closed.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
All right, we're assuming Brian played something. Step one here, story one. The budget deal. Okay, so as you alluded to, I'm seeing that as we're speaking right now, they may vote on it. And the last I heard, it was easily likely to clear the Senate, because I think that's where the deal originated, but might not clear the House. We'll see about that. But that's speculation. Let's talk details. What's in the deal and what is sequestration?
Sure. So there have been a number of news outlets that are reporting the deal, and I think the reports that I have seen, in my view, don't accurately emphasize exactly what's happening with respect to this proposed deal, right? So here are the kind of the big bullet points that you'll see if you're following this story. And if you listen to the show, you're obviously following the story. It doesn't involve anything on DACA.
Yeah, that's what I was...
Okay. Oh, go ahead.
That's what I was, as I've been reading these stories, I'm like, where's the DACA part? I don't get it. I thought that was the whole point, right? I mean, I thought that was the whole deal. Are we just taking Mitch McConnell's word for it that someday maybe they'll take a look at DACA?
So yes, in the sense that the DACA deadline is March 5th. And so there is, so this, let's be very, very clear, does nothing on DACA. Democrats are going to say in two ways that they maintain some kind of leverage. And those two items of leverage are, number one, the March 5th application deadline. It's been set by the court and by the Trump administration.
Okay, but how is that leverage for Republicans? Don't they just not care?
Yeah, well, right. And what Democrats will say is, we came to the table to do this, and Republicans let that lapse and don't care. Right. That's that's their leverage, is you're going to get killed on this in the midterm elections. I don't view that as, again, this isn't a political analysis show. I don't view that as having a substantial likelihood of swaying an awful lot of Republican votes. The second issue that you will see Democrats mention is that there will be a vote on the consolidated omnibus budget, which is due on March 23rd. This current proposal has one more of these short-term stopgaps that funds the government through March 23rd. It's going to require another vote. So there is the opportunity to blow everything up on March the 23rd. Mm. I don't place a lot of stock in that either, because this deal is going to be, has already hit the airwaves as ending the squabbles over short-term funding. Right. That's how both sides are selling this bill. And to bring that back up, I think Chuck Schumer in particular has said that's not going to be politically beneficial for us as Democrats. So DACA is off the table. And I'm not optimistic that anything is going to get done with respect to that. And it is a tragedy.
Wow.
That being said, I think the characterization of so you might then ask, okay, well, if the Democrats aren't going to draw a line in the sand on DACA, what have they done? What are they getting out of
this
bill? Yeah,
what is the deal part?
right. And here's where I think, and again, I don't, you know, you have to make your judgment on the Democrats independently, but I think that the stories are not effectively conveying what the Democrats have done. Mm. So I have seen, they've essentially said Democrats get funding for government stuff, right? And so here's some of that stuff, right? There's a hurricane disaster relief package. You might sit there going, that doesn't seem like that should be a partisan issue. It doesn't, but, you know, one of our major political parties has as its governing principle that the government shouldn't do anything. So that's required to be part of this. $6 billion in funding for the opioid epidemic. We just talked about that in OA 142. That's not a lot of money.
It is Republican. So, like, which side of the opioid epidemic are they?
You never know. $6 billion, right, to make the opioid epidemic worse.
Is that insane? I mean, net neutrality, you never would have thought anybody would be on the other side of that.
Yeah, I hope, again, this is allocated. I should mention the budget deal is 652 pages long and leaked this morning. So I do not want to say that I have read.
I would be on page 3.5 right now if that were me, but I'm not the lawyer.
I spent 2 hours going through it, and I made it through a big chunk, but I cannot claim to have been through all 652 pages.
Side note, but have you been following the where Trump is in the 10-page?
Oh yeah, I was going to make that joke later on. Yeah. Okay. In the new Diaz memo. Yeah, we should leave that in.
Sure. It's a teaser.
Yep. So as far as I can tell, that $6 billion is a block authorization. So hopefully, coupled with the Senate report that we talked about on OA 142, it will actually be directed in a way that is effective. I'm not holding out a ton of hope for that, but it is what it is. There's some money for VA clinics. There's $20 billion for infrastructure projects. Haven't been able to drill down into the specifics of those, and neither, I think, has any member of the U.S. Senate. 10 years of funding for the CHIP program, so that's an additional 4 years. And then some additional healthcare funding for community health centers and that sort of thing. And that's what the reporting has kind of focused on. And to me, it ignores the most important component of this. And again, I'm not saying politically I want you to say that this outweighs doing nothing on DACA or not, but it nevertheless is a major change. And that is that this bill would end what we have talked about on the show as one of the features of the landscape over the past almost 5 years now, which is budget sequestration. Huh. And I think that's a massive change.
Oh, it is wow. So the whole stupid thing itself that Republican Tea Party jerks set up a while back.
That's why, as we go to press, the question is this going to stall out in the House of Representatives? The Tea Party caucus is going to vote against this bill. So let's talk a little bit about what sequestration is and why I'm really, really happy to see it go away. I want to be clear on that. Again, you weigh it however you want. I am very happy to see sequestration going away. I was just talking this week. I did a record for our friends over at the Wayward Willis podcast. And the fact that we've had 5 years of courts operating at essentially 70% capacity is something that impacts me directly as a lawyer on a day-to-day basis. I have friends who are judges, and every judge I know, every prosecutor I know, every public defender I know, everybody who's involved in the administration of justice, left, right, center, is feeling the pinch of basically having 70 cents to the dollar for the past 5 years. That's one area that I happen to see because it intersects my life. But large chunks of the government have been limping along for 5 years because they've been drastically underfunded. So what is sequestration? Sequestration is the result of, I'm trying to make the right analogy. Thomas, have you ever seen Footloose?
No.
No, I know, dinosaur movie. There is.
Well, if it was a dinosaur movie, I probably would have seen it.
Yeah, well, a dinosaur superhero movie. That it would.
No, that's
who knows.
Okay.
No, Footloose is a classic, and one of the most unintentionally hilarious scenes from the movie Footloose is there is a tractor chicken sequence while I believe it's Holding Out for a Hero by Bonnie Tyler plays in the background, and two incredibly slow moving vehicles are moving towards each other while this stirring 80s music plays. And it's just hilarious. That's the perfect metaphor for the Budget Control Act of 2011. Mm. The Obama administration said, okay, we care about budget deficits. Why? Because it's a Democratic president and Democrats are fiscally responsible, despite the rhetoric to the contrary by libertarians and Republicans, obviously. And so Obama said, look, like, we've got these sort of out of control budget deficits. The best way to get it under control is to play a game of chicken and to say, we're going to throw it to the Congress, because even by 2011, Congress was dysfunctional and broken and not getting anything done. We're going to throw it to the Congress, require them to come up with a balanced budget proposal. And if they don't produce a bill that had at least $1.2 trillion in cuts, then all of a sudden, what's going to kick in is 2 years from now, January of 2013, would be massive, horrible, terrible cuts that are split 50-50 between stuff Democrats like, which is discretionary spending and government programs, and stuff Republicans like, which is the defense budget.
Right.
And so that's going to be awful. It's going to cripple the Department of Defense. It's going to cripple every aspect of government. Nobody wants that. That is such a bad outcome. Of course, Congress will reach a budget deal, and that's the worst incentive we can think of in the background. Since this happened 5 years ago, and since we live in the United States, you can probably guess that when we got to 2013, Republicans were like, "Yeah, you know what? I'm kind of okay with this."
Wow.
And they should have been. This was, if you want to pick apart the Obama administration, and we have done this, and talk about the flaws of Barack Obama as a president, certainly the mishandling of the rollout of Obamacare and the mishandling of the drafting of Obamacare. We've talked about that at great length. This qualifies, I think, as an unforced error. This is one of the dumbest and worst things that the Obama administration did. This qualifies under the heading of thanks, Obama. So we hit sequestration. And the reason we hit sequestration is because Republicans rightly looked at the landscape and said, you know what? All the stuff Democrats want is diffused over a lot of different government programs, and we can call that all government spending. And the stuff we want is paying money for our troops. And I'm betting we can get a lot of that back anyway in subsequent deals and kind of force Democrats to be like, are you really voting against body armor for, you know, troops in Afghanistan and stuff like that? And as it turns out, that's exactly what happened. So that deal extended sequestration for 2 more years out to 2023, and in exchange for that, reduced some of the burden of the sequestration in 2013 and 2014, but did so in such a way that shifted the balance away from 50-50 defense discretionary spending to more like 60-40. So that's the world we've been operating in. This bill repeals the Budget Control Act of 2011. It ends the mandatory caps backed up by sequestration that otherwise would have been in effect for an additional 5 years. And I think that's an unambiguously good thing. Now, mind you, maybe I shouldn't have used the word unambiguously. It is an unambiguously good thing standing alone. When coupled with a tax bill that absolutely is going to blow an unbelievable hole in the budget deficit, I can only begin to imagine the net effect of those two things working in concert. And I think it's kind of amazing that we have a Republican Party right now that, under the direction of its president, said it is more important for us to preserve our position on immigration than to preserve our position on cutting government spending. I think that I'm just going to let that sit, stand alone out there. 2020 would be a great time for Ross Perot to run for president again. What? Maybe we can add him to our pool.
Like actual Ross Perot?
I think the actual Ross Perot is still. What I mean by that is, in 1992, Ross Perot ran a third-party presidential campaign solely on the issue of deficit reduction.
Right.
And went on national television with bar graphs and charts and really brought that issue into the public consciousness. He was kind of crazy. But I think he greatly shaped the debate for years to come as a result of his presidential run. And that issue, I think is not going to be well represented. I could be wrong, but I think it's not going to be well represented by a party by 2020. Donald Trump will be running for re-election, and Donald Trump doesn't care about deficit reduction. And the Democratic Party will be running not on deficit reduction, but on trying to fix the damage that Donald Trump has done over the past 4 years. And look, you know, there is a real issue here with respect to sort of this long-term notion of every time Republicans get into office, they enact unfunded tax cuts that they say are going to pay for themselves that never pay for themselves, that do crippling damage to the economy that Democrats have to come in and fix. That's going to happen. This is going to exacerbate it, but at least our courts are going to run in the meantime. So
yeah, that's interesting. It'd be nice to get rid of that, but we'll see how this comes out with DACA. I really don't understand the thinking there, but whatever. Well, I guess we'll see. But that was at this pace, Mr. Torres, you're not going to get through the stories that we need to get through. So I will encourage you to try mode that I know you don't have.
Right.
And let's talk about gerrymandering.
Yay, gerrymandering. No, wait, I'm sorry. That was not yay, gerrymandering. I'm not cheering for that. You may have seen, we covered the North Carolina gerrymandering decision. That case was the implementation of that case was stayed by a per curiam order of the Supreme Court. That was episode OA-138. And the Supreme Court said that insofar as the lower court's decision directs the revision of House districts in Wake County and Mecklenburg County, it is stayed pending the timely filing and disposition of an appeal in this court. And what that means is that the gerrymandered North Carolina districts are going to stay in effect for the 2018 election. That was a pretty big victory for Republicans in that case. That granting of the stay to many people, right? You're trying to read the tea leaves of where is Anthony Kennedy. At the same time, the Supreme Court declined to take an appeal in the redistricting case in Pennsylvania. And this is really, really interesting. The case is League of Women Voters versus Pennsylvania. And by declining to take the case, right, what that tells us, it tells us two things. So the petition went to Samuel Alito. Alito declined to take the petition and did not refer the case to the full Supreme Court to vote on it. And what that means is that unlike Roberts, who did so with the North Carolina case, that means there weren't four votes to examine the case. And not being four votes means you don't have five votes, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you're riding kind of the roller coaster of emotions of what does this mean, you know, if you were at the low part of the roller coaster following North Carolina, then this is a swing back up. I personally hate roller coasters, so I don't know why I use that metaphor. but as it's playing with your emotions and you're trying to read the tea leaves and figure out what Anthony Kennedy is thinking, I think he is aware that this is a significant issue and it rests on his shoulders. And I think that's a good thing. The Pennsylvania case is neat. The reason we didn't cover it is because it's entirely a state case. So we've been trying to cover the cases, as in North Carolina, like the ones that are pending before the Supreme Court in Wisconsin and Maryland, that are based on the federal rights protected by the Constitution, because that's what's going to affect the entirety of the country. The Pennsylvania case found that the redistricting violated the Pennsylvania state constitution, in particular Article 1, Section 5, which says, "Elections shall be free and equal, and no power, civil or military, shall at any time interfere to prevent the free exercise of the right to suffrage." Mm. So not a right that's guaranteed in the Bill of Rights, more
robust. I was going to say, maybe we should add that.
Yeah. Yeah. Can we also put in, right, and it's bad when Russians get to control our elections like that. I would like to, if we're proposing doing the Pennsylvania amendment to the U.S. Constitution, I'd like to add in.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to get too crazy with the amendment, but I'd say word it something like, do more than absolutely nothing when Russians meddle.
I agree. There we go. Thomas.
Isn't there a legal term for that? It has to be more than, what was that?
De minimis is the term.
Yeah. De minimis. Yeah, there we go. Do more than de minimis.
There you go. Perfect use of legal vocabulary, too, by the way. New segment, Thomas
Thanks.
Rewrites
as long
the Constitution.
As I ask you for the word, I can do it well, yeah.
So one of the things that came out as a result of the Pennsylvania case that I want to share with our listeners are two PowerPoint presentations. And these are kind of amazing when you go through them. And I hope that they are made part of the supplemental record in the Wisconsin.
Like it's really good PowerPoint animation effects?
No, these are from 2008 and 2010, respectively. So they are at the dawn of PowerPoint as a presentational tool.
But, what are you talking about? I was using PowerPoint in high school.
Oh, really? Yeah. I was using Dittos in high school. I'm not that much older than you, goddammit. All right. So these are two PowerPoints related to the Red Map Project, right? And they show the evolution of gerrymandering as an explicit political tool. So 2008 was the first time.
Right. There's like a bubble that says like evil plan. And then it's like Republican, like screw people out of votes. That kind of PowerPoint.
The 2010 PowerPoint is almost at that level. I'm not kidding. Like, it is almost as if the PowerPoint has a snidely whiplash mustache and is standing over train tracks. Like, it's amazing. We'll get there. So 2008, okay. The Republicans are a little bit, they have raised this as a political issue. And that 2008 presentation shows the growing trend towards wresting control of redistricting away from Democrats. So it mentions in 1990 that redistricting committees were 240 split control or neutral, 172 in the hands of Democrats, and only 5 in the hands of Republicans. And then by 2000, that was up from 5 to 96 Republicans. Split control was down from 240 to 161, and Democrats were down from 172 to 135. And then it details the gains that were made between 1990 and 2000 in various states. And then that memo ends with an explicit appeal to the strategy for Republicans in 2010 and beyond, which was to target state legislatures, particularly those state legislatures where one party held 5 or fewer seats in a majority, right? And try and take the majority of state legislatures, to dump extra money into gubernatorial races where the governor has veto power over the redistricting maps. And then funneling money down from the RNC level to fund campaigns, technology, all that sort of stuff, and to make sure that every Republican state legislature has a redistricting lawyer on staff. All of that set out in this 2008 memo, and that happened. That was implemented. The 2010 memo is, all right, we're now, well, yeah, we bought it. We're 2 years into this process. The 2010 memo has a slide that says, how do we create 20 to 25 new Republican congressional districts over the next 5 cycles and solidify a Republican congressional majority? Right. That's slide number 8. You click to slide number 9 and it says, the answer, question mark, control the redistricting process, exclamation point. It then goes through and says there are pages highlighted, maps matter, the first tool in winning elections. And then they go through various states where in the 2000s, they were able to gerrymander and reach results that didn't reflect the state as a whole. So there's an in-depth discussion of Texas, and then there's the discussion of Pennsylvania. And it says the Pennsylvania delegation in 2000 was 11 Republicans and 10 Democrats and was set to lose 2 congressional seats in reapportionment. The Republican-controlled legislature drew maps that put 2 Democrat congressmen into the same district and another into a heavy Republican district. The delegation went to 12 Republicans and 7 Democrats after the 2002 election with the new Republican maps. As somebody who's litigated cases, this is what you call a smoking gun document,
yeah.
Right? This says, hi, we have created a national strategy designed to take 50-50 states and subvert the electoral process in order to further entrench our majority.
Didn't we already know all this, though? Like, isn't this all, doesn't it all not really matter until somebody finally says, like, wait, you can't do that?
Yeah, no, but remember that the Kennedy plurality in the redistricting cases is hypothetically, yes, it's bad that gerrymandering, political gerrymandering, takes away the principle of one man, one vote. We think that this is a bad thing, but I don't have a really good metric to figure out exactly when this has taken place. And now what those cases do is offer, we've talked about the surplus voting metric and the computing power to be able to run, right? In the North Carolina scenario, they brought an expert in who ran 20,000 proposed maps and showed that in 99% of them, the Republicans lost seats. But shockingly, with this map, the Republicans gained seats, right? So we've solved the data problem. And so then the other side is the proof of intent problem, right? Remember we've talked about how because of the overlap between identification of political party and membership in a minority group, right? It's always been the perspective that, you know, drawing a district to minimize the number of Black people is a violation of not just the Voting Rights Act, but the Fifth and 14th Amendments. But the defense has been, oh, well, you know, we're just trying to minimize Democrats. And moving from this is kind of a loose proxy to no, we saw this process and we engineered it in such a way that the Democrats would lose and the Republicans would win. In my view, that pushes us a step down the line. That's a harder argument. If you're Anthony Kennedy, that's a harder argument to swallow than just, well, you know, to the victor go the spoils, and Democrats do it and Republicans do it, and it's all kind of the same thing. Yeah, once you get into people talking about, here's how, without, and that's what this document says, right? Like, that's the key predicate to this issue is, without making Republicans or Republican policies any more popular in these states, how can we win more elections, right? And that's why it's a bad document. That's why it, I think, has strong intuitive persuasive appeal, and I think it will have some legal persuasive appeal.
Well, that's good. I mean, I thought we were so far past that it was just like, yeah, we all know it's happening. Nobody's denying it's happening. We just need the Supreme Court to finally say, like, oh no, you can't do that.
Yeah, and look, the Supreme Court has had, right, those kind of two line drawing questions, right? The how do we measure, and also how do we differentiate between, you know, the ordinary kind of to the victor go the spoils versus something that really seems to cross the line. And in my view, this helps illustrate how things cross the line.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was sort of lightning round worthy. I think you did a good job there, and that's good. So maybe we will get through this after all. Let's go.
I'm optimistic.
Next topic. Next topic, the Nunes memo.
Yeah.
And it's not
go
Nunes,
ahead. You want to summarize?
By the way.
Yeah,
let me summarize the Nunes memo. It's nothing. Okay.
I think that's right. Illustrating the degree of nothingness, this needs to accompany every single article about the Nunes memo, and it's why I'm going to say it here. Trey Gowdy went on Face the Nation. He is the only Republican member who saw the actual FISA application warrants that are at issue and under discussion in the Nunes memo. Mm. And he said, quote, "There is a Russia investigation without a dossier. So to the extent the memo deals with the dossier and the FISA process, the dossier has nothing to do with the meeting at Trump Tower." And again, I want to illustrate, this is Trey Gowdy, right? This is one of the most partisan Republicans in Congress.
Yeah.
The dossier.
Another person, by the way, another Republican congressman leaving.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's good.
The dossier has nothing to do with an email sent by Cambridge Analytica. The dossier really has nothing to do with George Papadopoulos's meeting in Great Britain. It also doesn't have anything to do with obstruction of justice. So there's going to be a Russia probe even without a dossier. We rebutted.
And that was just for the basics. I mean, everybody probably knows this, but that was the whole alleged bombshell, was that, and we all knew it was nothing, but the Republicans who were, you know, willing to go along with this absolutely just idiotic thing were saying, like, this memo will prove once and for all that the biased, like, Democrat funded dossier, Steele dossier, was the only reason that there's any investigation on Trump. And it's a Watergate level, you know, it's 9/11 times 1,000. It's 90,011, whatever the 9,011. And it's
dossiers don't burn that hot.
Yeah, no, that's a Team America joke. But it was going to be, you know, Watergate times 1,000. And then they publish it, and even their own document refutes that. Like, their own document had a date that predated the Steele dossier, from what so it's like they didn't even it's, what world are we living in, Andrew? I don't even, can there be consequences to things anymore?
No, there are no consequences to anything. I think we've proven that, right?
Yeah.
We've proven that everything is measured in terms of Yodel Mountain, and none of us know where the peak is. So
yeah,
what the Nunez memo covers is, in my view, a potentially interesting discussion about FISA courts and FISA warrants, which, again, let us remember, this was a law.
Republicans are all against FISA warrant or whatever now.
Yeah. But look, like, you know, so yes, this is a law. This is 50 USC section 1805. It was passed during the George W. Bush administration in the wake of 9/11. And it allows the government to go to a FISA judge and for that judge to enter an ex parte order. And by that ex parte, that means only one party. So in other words, you can get a surveillance warrant issued by a FISA court and not have to tell the person being surveilled. This, right, you might think that might contravene your constitutional rights to have, right? I mean, in an ordinary situation, you would have the right to be presented with a search warrant to know that, you know, if the government's going to enter your property and inspect your stuff. For very complicated reasons, this doesn't trigger that analysis because the Supreme Court has steadily eroded your Fourth Amendment rights over the past 30 years. So 50 USC 1805 allows a FISA court to issue an ex parte order. And subsection B specifically says, in determining whether or not probable cause exists for purposes of an order, a judge may consider past activities of the target, as well as, and this is, I'm reading directly from the law, facts and circumstances related to current or future activities of the target. And if that sounds pretty broad to you, it is, right? Like it's totally open-ended. And if Republicans want to argue that the law allowed the DOJ to go to a FISA court and get a warrant with evidence that wouldn't be admissible in court and that might not stand up to scrutiny and that that's a bad thing, I think I agree with them on that, right? I would love to see the FISA Act amended. I would love to see these courts eliminated or greatly reduced in power. We talked about this in opening arguments episode 106, and we talked about how FISA courts are rubber stamps for government applications, that fewer than 0.01% of the applications are ever denied, right? So it's a real bad system, but there is absolutely no doubt that the government appropriately applied the law, played by the rules in carrying out and
right.
Seeking
so
these
as
warrants.
A clarification, it's not as though it's always rubber stamped because the government is just not even following the rules. It's that the rules are really lax.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Right.
And you know, it is something for liberals to keep in mind. I think it has been grossly overblown. Like, you know, how sort of the preemptive, I think I've noticed something that's happened. Sorry, this is a little commentary, but I've noticed something that's happened is that when Republicans are about to go completely hypocritical on something, they start to pre-attack the Democrats for going hypocritical on the same issue. I've noticed that. So it's like during the stock market, you know, because it's been not good lately. And so the Republicans were like, oh, all of a sudden the stock market's Trump's fault. And it's like, what? Like you, no one said that. Like you were the ones who were saying it was Trump the whole time. You can't preemptively be like, oh, now I don't believe that. And you're the one who, anyway, it's the same thing has happened with, I think, with the FBI. Like, I don't think it's true that all Democrats are worshiping the FBI now. But at the same time, I think it's pretty easy to say, you know, yes, there are clear problems with law enforcement and with FISA courts and like all this stuff, but we can still evaluate how the rules are being applied here.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. And I think you did it. You did a great job of foreshadowing the next segment, which is going to talk about the stock market. I don't want to leave before we get to, in my view, the funniest part of this story, which is Democrats are pushing to release their 10-page rebuttal to the Nunez memo, which Trump chief of staff.
Well, because they were asking Paul Ryan. They were like, why are we releasing this? Like, people have said it's incomplete and it doesn't, you know, it's misleading because and it's like, oh, more transparency. Like, we just want more transparency. And it's like, well, are you releasing the Democratic memo? No.
Nope.
So for a while, they just didn't. And they still, I guess they still haven't released it, huh? Because it's, they're waiting for Trump to either turn it down or
prove it. Yeah, Trump has to declassify it. And and the excuse given 2 days ago, this is my favorite thing by Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, was it's a lengthy rebuttal and Donald Trump hasn't read it yet. and the memo, and he was then asked, when you say lengthy, he was like, oh yeah, yeah, 10 pages. So, I would say Donald Trump would have a hard time doing this show. How about that?
Yeah. Well, I would say there's no chance that even if it were like some Republican document that Trump needed and wanted to read, that he would ever read it. I mean, he would just have someone start trying to explain it to him and then lose track of it. Yeah, there's no way he's actually reading a 10-page document of any kind.
Yeah, no, who was the ghostwriter of Art of the Deal that, you know, was making the case in the election, which... Again, that Donald Trump literally like couldn't pay attention for more than 20 minutes to phone calls.
Well, we saw he could in fairness and objectivity here, we saw that he could deliver a State of the Union. You know, he can read a teleprompter for a certain amount of time. But
Where are the Republicans talking about how terrible it is that our president reads off a teleprompter?
Doesn't matter. That is the least of things that they're not doing. But okay, so now we've got this teaser for the next thing. Are we good to go to the next story?
Yeah, let's go to the next story.
All right, Federal Reserve and let's see, sanctions for Wells Fargo.
Yeah,
for all the fake accounts or what were they doing? They had that was pretty messed up.
So yeah, the reason it's a great teaser is that when the Dow dropped 1,175 points, the largest one-day drop in the history of the stock market, not percentage-wise, but numerically.
Yeah, just points-wise.
Related to that was Wells Fargo was a primary driver of that drop. It dropped 8%. And why did it drop 8%? Right. Because outgoing chairperson of the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, literally on her last day, Friday evening, announced that the Fed was going to pursue sanctions against Wells Fargo. And that is in connection, as you pointed out, with really gross levels of misconduct that included opening phony accounts. There were over 5,000 employees that have been fired by Wells Fargo that the company has admitted that because of the way they paid bonuses to their executives, that they had incentives to open up phony accounts in order to maximize the number of accounts and maximize the bonuses that they were earning. And obviously, there was so little oversight and the process was so rampant that, it affected thousands of people, right? That was not just uncoordinated. And then the company has also been alleged to have wrongly imposed overdraft and other fees, some in connection with the phony accounts, but some in connection with valid accounts. And if you get dinged by your bank for overdrawing your checking account, even if you have overdraft protection, that notice goes to the credit bureaus that rate your credit score. So in other words, this is a material harm that is, you can give people the money back, but when you have millions of people that have had these false dings on their credit report, it's pretty difficult to restore them in the position they should have been in had Wells Fargo not messed around with their accounts. So what happened? There is a law. It is 12 U.S.C. Section 1818. It's part of the Federal Deposit Insurance Act. And it says it says two things, right? Number one, the Federal Reserve has been delegated the power by Congress. So again, this is another one of these executive administrative agency actions. The Federal Reserve can take away a bank's FDIC status. That if they did that, right, that would put Wells Fargo out of business. That is the ultimate threat in the background. There may be some customers they retain through inertia, but there is absolutely no reason you would put your money in a bank that is not federally insured when you could go to some other national bank and put your money in, even in an oligopolistic system where there aren't a lot of national banks.
Yeah,
and,
go to non-evil banking incorporated. Right.
Yeah, so that's a pretty big threat. In furtherance of that threat, the lesser authority that the Fed has is if, in their opinion, a covered bank, quote, is engaging or has engaged, or the agency has reasonable cause to believe that the depository institution or any institution-affiliated party is about to engage in an unsafe or unsound practice in conducting the business of such institution, or is violating or has violated, or the agency has reasonable cause to believe that the institution or any institution-affiliated party is about to violate a law, rule, regulation, they may issue a cease and desist letter. And as a condition of that, they can say, you're not going to be able to do things until you prove to us that the problem has been fixed. And that's exactly what Janet Yellen did on her way out from the Fed. So the cease and desist letter requires Wells Fargo to terminate the three members of its board that it has come out were the most culpable in these fake in covering up the fake account scandal, right? Because that the fake accounts, the admission goes back internally to 2016. The fact that we're talking about it now is because the company engaged in efforts to cover it up, and the three board members that are the most culpable have to be terminated or resign. And Wells Fargo must submit a plan within 60 days to show how it's never going to do this again. And until the Fed signs off on the plan, Wells Fargo is prohibited from increasing its assets through any way other than customer deposits. So what that means is if you bank at Wells Fargo, you can still go deposit money into your savings account or buy products from Wells Fargo. But Wells Fargo can't engage. They can't engage in another merger with smaller local or regional banks, which, by the way, is pretty much all Wells Fargo has done for the past 10 years. Right. Like that's their business model. And they cannot engage in, quote, a major transaction until the terms and conditions of the cease and desist notice have been approved by the Fed. So that is...
Well, no wonder they their stock tanked.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty extreme.
Yeah. And our next president, Elizabeth Warren, this has been, obviously, banking regulations are a signature issue for Liz Warren. And she said, Chair Yellen's decision today to freeze the growth of Wells Fargo until it shapes up demonstrates that we have the tools to rein in Wall Street if our regulators have the guts to use them. This one hits them where it hurts. Finds, and I really, the reason I'm reading this is because I thought this was an interesting distinction that I hadn't thought of before. She says, fines alone will never rein in fraudulent behavior at the big banks. We need tough penalties that affect the actual lives of the people who run the banks. By pushing out board members at Wells Fargo, Chair Yellen sent a strong message. And I thought that was a really interesting.
Well, yeah, isn't that always point. The thing, which is like the fine will be like $1 million, but meanwhile, they made 20 bajillion dollars on doing whatever they did. So no one cares.
Yeah, exactly right. And so you may see this as kind of the blueprint for the democratic model of going after these businesses, banks that are too big to fail and saying, hey, look, like we are not. And the nice thing about this is it sidesteps the kinds of typical political concerns, right? The, oh yeah, you know, you're targeting these companies and the workers there are going to be hurt and the customers are going to have to pay the, right? So, so saying, okay, great. What we want are orders that affect the people who engaged in the bad decision-making. And what we want are orders that prevent companies from continuing to grow and continuing to insulate themselves into the too big to fail category while they remediate the behavior that was a problem. So I thought that was really, really interesting. And from a legal perspective, I would imagine that Wells Fargo will likely, they have said that they're going to file their remediation plan. So they're not going to file a lawsuit at this point challenging the order. To do so, what they would need to do is file a declaratory judgment lawsuit arguing that the Fed acted ultra vires, right? That it acted beyond the delegated powers that are delegated to the Federal Reserve by Congress under the FDIA. That's going to be a very, very hard argument until Neil Gorsuch manages to overturn Chevron deference. And so right now it's still a hard argument. I want to flag that, right? Like this is, I want that to be my signature issue. Put it on, I'm not going to have a tombstone, but you know, if I were to have an epitaph, you know, fought for Chevron deference could be my epitaph. But you see how this is interconnected, right? Right? Like this would allow, if there were no Chevron deference, Wells Fargo would be in a much stronger position to take an argument before a politically motivated court and say, you got to stop this. Because there is, they're not. They're in a weaker position. And they've said that they're going to comply with at least the first 60 days. What happens after that? Yellen is on her way out, the incoming chair of the Fed.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. I mean, can the incoming chair just be like, crazy Yellen, let's get rid of this.
So in other words, the answer is yes. The new Federal Reserve chair could just approve of a pretty bare bones plan. That person is Jerome Powell, who served in the George W. Bush administration as Undersecretary of the Treasury. Everything I have been able to read about him is that when the pick was made, which was the nomination was made back in October. And so Yellen has been serving in a transitional period from October until now. And the pick at the time was seen as a centrist pick and obviously was made without this Wells Fargo order in place or in mind. So the pick at the time was seen as a centrist pick. We will stay tuned in 2 months to see what happens. I certainly think if I were general counsel to Wells Fargo, and they could probably use some good legal counsel right about now. I would not be confident that just because a new pick is coming in that you could write some kind of garbage plan and have it rubber stamped. But we'll find out. Obviously Wells Fargo is going to be doing as much research on Powell as they can. I will add as a tidbit that, perhaps befitting his status as a George W. Bush appointee and Donald Trump appointee, and this is a cheap political shot, that, Jerome Powell is the first Federal Reserve chair in four decades not to have an advanced degree in economics. So,
bad start.
So that I want to be clear that that's a little bit of a cheap partisan shot. You know, he was Undersecretary of the Treasury. It's not like, you know, he was an English teacher or something prior to to coming into this post.
No Trump supporter would be an English
teacher. Well, that's
but I get what you
mean. All right.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well,
I think that's probably it. So.
All right. Well, in true Andrew Torres fashion, you lightning rounded a little bit faster than just normal, like a tiny amount faster than just not even doing a lightning round. So, but that's Andrew Torres Esquire, everybody.
I think my pace was heroic.
Yeah. Yeah. Slightly faster than normal, but that's good. It's because you don't want to leave any good, important legal info out. And I respect that. So it is now time to thank our patrons.
Yay! All right, who's going first? You or me?
That's you, sorry.
Yeah, this is our co-favorite time of the week when we thank our Hall of Fame patrons, our all-time greats, and they are Heather Loveridge, Adopt a Homeless Podcaster at a Adopt a Homeless Podcaster at a Poe's Noisy Neighbor Cat barking. How appropriate for the show. This Week in News with Kevin and Benedict. Thomas and Andrew are full of midgets. Look, if you are not a patron of the show, you're missing out on all of these great jokes. Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. Rest in peace, Ogre. Hashtag end the death penalty. Hashtag justice for Ogre. If we could get hashtag justice for Ogre to trend, my life will be complete. C6, Sarah, Sammy, the Fifth Beetle, Roger Metcalf, Rhonda the Dork, Rebecca Smelzer, Reagan like the President Klein. Nope, 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 nope. Our first patron, Danny Rosari, adopt a homeless pet at a pose, declawing and ear docking. The Unaccomplished Woodsman, the Wayward Willis podcast just did their show. When it comes out, I'll link it in the show notes. Philip Stromberg, Tricicular Manslaughter, Squick Thinger, Please Check Your Lost and Found, I Can't Find My Boulder, Legalize the Perjury, like that. And Thomas always starts at the feet because of envy.
Ooh, and thank you to Malaika Chandler. Jesse Studd is my favorite lawyer. Andrew is a close second. Sasquatch Hunters with Pitchforks and Glow Sticks. Soul, Jim Grove. Dave, reluctant investor in Thomas's Second Chance Surgery Center, Nichols. Ian and Alley, RaymondSpecialties.com, custom survey gear. NotaryKink.com on the American internet. Eli Bosnick, Sam Danow, Foxhole Atheist, Soggy Pants, Adam Linda, Aaron Grady, Saka Shithole Thwackasumi. Wiley E. Trump Stable Genius. Frederick Alstromer, Mitchell, Mr. Ed was a stable genius. Eric Johnson, Dredrick Tatum, heavyweight champion of the world. Andrew has three fewer Super Bowl losses than Tom Brady. Conrad Michaels, thank you guys so much. Oh, it is so fun going through those names. That was good times.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for the bar exam, TGBE, but we have a special guest today. Lucian Greaves, who will be on the show on Tuesday, is here to play along. We're going to find out if satanic law is the same as regular law.
Let's see.
It's good to take a wait and see approach. I'm a fan of that. All right. So Thomas, Lucian, here's your question. For many years, Schnauzer, a supplier of dog food, had accepted orders for dog food from Chow, the owner of a pet store, over the telephone. One day, Chow telephoned Schnauzer and ordered 840-pound bags of dog food, priced at $20 per bag, to be delivered to his store at the rate of 100 per month starting in January. On January 1, Schnauzer delivered 100 bags. With his check in payment for the delivery, Chow sent Schnauzer a note saying, $20 per bag is too high. I will not take the other 700 bags, signed Chow. Schnauzer files suit, alleging that Chow promised to buy 800 bags of dog food from him. In his defense, Chow pleads the statute of frauds. How should the court rule on this issue? So, Thomas and Lucian, here are your choices. And again, how should the court rule on this issue? A, for Schnauzer, because the note sent with Chow's check constitutes a writing sufficient to satisfy the statute of frauds. B, for Chow, because the note sent with Chow's check was a repudiation rather than a memorandum of the oral agreement. C, for Chow, because the note sent with Chow's check does not satisfy the statute of frauds. Or D, for Schnauzer, because Chow received and accepted part of the goods. So this relies on your extensive understanding of the principle of the statute of frauds. And can't wait to hear where you come out on that. Thomas, take it away.
I guess my main confusion here is how the note, it says like most of the answers are pinned upon the note sent either does or doesn't satisfy the statute of frauds. But it's like the note is just Chow saying, I don't want to buy the rest. So like, what is that? I don't really understand, I guess, legally how that satisfies the statute of frauds. Well, I'm going to try to eliminate, I don't know. I have no clue. I don't understand how the statute of frauds is applied in this case. So common sense would lead me to believe that, you know, the supplier should have some recourse here. So I'm going to err toward a for Schnauzer answer, and I'll just guess that it's, I'll just go with D for Schnauzer because Chow received and accepted part of the goods.
Yeah, I have to believe they have some recourse to law also. So I would agree with that.
And that's our show for today. I have no clue on that bar question. So I essentially took a pass on this one, but we'll see if I get lucked into the right answer. But also I like when the guest is the same one as me so that no one's embarrassed. I think that's the best game theory, that's like the best thing to do. But thanks for listening, Andrew, and also thanks for covering, you know, a little more than you would have in your in admittedly Andrew's version of the lightning round, which is, it's, you know, it's a little faster, a little more stuff, but plenty, always more to talk about. And we will see you for a really cool interview with Lucian Greaves on the Satanic Temple and the Missouri abortion lawsuit on Tuesday. Now, as I mentioned before, I also did an interview with Jex Blackmore, also of the Satanic Temple, but we tried to cover different ground. And so it's kind of a nice little two-parter, like complimentary thing. If you want to check out Monday's episode of Serious Inquiries Only, that covers more detail about the Satanic Temple and the origin, and specifically some of the things Jex Blackmore has done within that. It's really interesting stuff. And so we're doing a little complimentary podcast action there. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So, hey, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you then.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.